Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Olimpia Musumeci. I am professor of neurology at the University of Messina in Italy, and I'm working at the unit of neuromuscle disorders and rare neurological disorders still in Messina. My main scientific interest is in neurogenetics, in muscle disease, in particular metabolic myopathies and mitochondrial disease. This month's topic is about neuromuscle disorders. In today's episode, we will talk about red flags in treatable rare myopathies. It's a pleasure to introduce today my guests. They are two leading experts in the neuromuscle field, Professor Antonio Toscano, Professor Marianne de Visser. Professor Antonio Toscano is a full professor of neurology at University of Messina in Italy. He is currently secretary of EAN and has previously served as treasurer. He is particularly dedicated to the diagnosis, management and treatment of metabolic myopathies as muscle glycogenesis, lipid storage myopathy, mitochondrial disorders and genetic myopathies. Professor Marianne de Visser is emeritus professor of neuromuscle diseases at the University of Amsterdam. She led the neuromuscle group at the academic medical centers in Amsterdam for several years, with expertise on muscle dystrophies, myositis, post-polio syndrome, motor neuron diseases, and hereditary neuropathies. She has held leadership roles in the European level, serving as governing board on EAN, first as treasurer and then as secretary general. Welcome, Marianne, and welcome, Antonio, and thank you for joining us today. We can start with the first question, and I would like to ask to Antonio, what about do you think about over last decade about what we have the advances on to improve the diagnosis of rare genetic myopathies as muscle dystrophy or metabolic myopathies? How do you think nowadays it changed the diagnostic approach on this disease?
Yes, thanks very much, Olimpia, for this question. And I would like to also welcome Professor de Visser, who is a very nice friend of us. And about this question, it's a very relevant question in the neuromuscular field. Definitely in the last 10 years, I would say, there was a different approach to the diagnostic phases and for neuromuscular, and more specifically for muscle disorders. As a premise, I would outline that still is very important to have a correct work frame of the clinical aspects, and that it's important to guide all the diagnostic processes starting from the clinical aspects of the every single patient. And after that, we still need some generic laboratory studies, for example, from blood samples to have a dosage of the CK, creatine kinase, because it's very relevant for several kind of disorder. But this is already well known. What has changed, in my opinion, in the last 10 years is especially the use of muscle MRI, which is very relevant, especially to help us to establish the real condition of muscles in the patient and to try to indicate what are the most affected muscle groups. And this is also important if you still need to perform a muscle biopsy, so you have a good drive from the muscle MRI. But even more relevant is the molecular genetic era. So today we have the opportunity to use molecular genetic pathways to try to recognize the different subspecialty of muscle disorders. And this is a very relevant, but still not always able to give us a complete information about the genetic disorder, because we usually have something like 60-70% of detection rate of disorders, but still there is a number of myopathy that remain unknown or not recognized. In any case, today, using all the SOMIC studies, the improvement of muscle disorders diagnosis is very relevant. We can also still use some targeted panels when we know already what are the genetic alterations in the family. But, of course, the use of the genomic and exomic studies is very relevant today and very helpful. Last note for the muscle biopsy, because we still say 10, 15 years ago, muscle biopsy was the gold standard for muscle diagnosis. But now, with the advent of the genetic molecular studies, is less used, but it's still very useful, especially in cases when we are not exactly sure about the genetic destination of the studies, but also when you have not exhausted responses from the molecular genetic studies. In this case, the muscle biopsy could be fundamental.
Yes, thanks, Antonio, for your talk. And of course, genetic analysis changed the approach of a patient who is suspicious of hereditary myopathy, but still muscle biopsy has a role either in the diagnostic approach when genetic goes first. And now going to another field about muscle disorders and talking about inflammatory myopathies. Also in this field, in the recent year, we have several advances on pathophysiology, diagnostic recognition that can modify also the diagnostic approach. Marianne, can you give you some clues on this topic? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Olympia. It's really a great honor to join you and Professor Antonio Toscano in this podcast. And before responding to your question, I would like to take the opportunity to first briefly discuss the classification of idiopathic inflammatory myopathies. About 20 years ago, we distinguished three subtypes: dermatomyositis, polymyositis, and inclusion body myositis. However, over the years, thanks to new insights based on serological findings of myositis-specific autoantibodies and muscle pathology, but also muscle imaging, we now distinguish five subtypes: dermatomyositis, immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy, antisynthetase syndrome, overlap myositis, and inclusion body myositis. And you may have noticed that I do not mention polymyositis anymore, because it has become clear that probably this disease entity does not exist anymore, or is at least extremely rare. In the past, patients with antisynthetase syndrome, overlap myositis, immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy, or IBM have been misdiagnosed as polymyositis. To come back to your question about advances on pathophysiology and diagnosis, indeed, there are major advances as regards pathomechanisms in dermatomyositis, immune-mediated necrotizing myopathies, and inclusion body myositis, which are not only relevant for diagnosis, but also for therapeutic approaches and for monitoring disease activity. Recent studies have highlighted the pathogenic roles of myositis-specific autoantibodies. First, there is a positive correlation between the levels of specific myositis-associated autoantibodies, MSAs, in serum and disease activity, which supports a role of MSAs in pathogenesis. Second, autoantibodies may accumulate inside myofibers, disrupting the function of their target proteins. And this has been shown for the anti-Me2 autoantibody, an MSA for dermatomyositis, or JO1, an MSA for antisynthetase syndrome. Pathogenicity of the MSAs has also been established for anti-SRP and anti-HMGCR autoantibodies, which are associated with immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy. All these observations have relevance for the clinical practice. MSAs can be used for defining the specific phenotypes. Let me give you a few examples. The anti-MDA5 antibody in dermatomyositis is associated with a high prevalence of interstitial lung disease and skin ulcers and relatively little muscle weakness. Another example is the anti-TIF1 gamma autoantibody in dermatomyositis, which indicates a risk factor for cancer. These are a few examples of the utility of MSAs for diagnosis. Another important finding is the identification of the interferon pathway, which plays an important role in dermatomyositis. Interferons are cytokines that predominantly activate the JAK-STAT signaling pathway, leading to expression of interferon-inducible genes. There are various types of interferons, but the induction of type 1 interferon in dermatomyositis is reflected by increased expression of interferon-inducible genes in muscle, in blood, and in skin, and that has led to the detection of a diagnostic marker, the type 1 interferon-inducible protein MXA, mixovir-resistant protein A, which can be found in perivesicular myofibers in muscle biopsies of patients with dermatomyositis and not in other myositis subtypes. The developments as regards pathomechanism are also very relevant for advancement of therapies. Based on the overexpression of interferons that, as I mentioned, activate the JAK-STAT signaling pathway, JAK inhibitors are administered to patients with dermatomyositis and seem to hold promise. And there is emerging evidence supporting the use of blood-based biomarkers of the type 1 interferon pathway for monitoring of treatment response, and these biomarkers can be used in patient stratification for targeted treatment, particularly with JAK inhibitors. And finally, the identification of highly differentiated cytotoxic T cells and their role in IBM has led to the development of promising targeted therapies, which are currently undergoing clinical trials.
Thanks, Marianne. Of course, definitely the field of inflammatory myopathies over the last year changed completely in terms of classification, but also in terms of diagnosis. All the identification of these new antibodies is important not just for the diagnosis, but also for the treatment, the management of these patients. So it is fundamental to be updated on all of these things. So, a new question for Antonio, and going back to the genetic form, what do you think we can identify as clinical red flags, in your opinion, to shorten the diagnostic delay that is still over the years present in the diagnosis of this patient?
Yes, Olympia, this is a very important question, and it needs a little bit larger response, because there are several aspects that have to be outlined in terms of red flags in myopathies. So we first need to know what kind of duration of the disease we are trying to identify. So we can have acute disorders, but we also have, in the majority of cases, chronic disorders. So Marianne has already discussed about the acute situation, especially in inflammatory myopathies, but we have a large number of other kinds of disorders that are chronic disorders, and they are quite slow but still disabling for the patients. So we have to consider several aspects when we have to pay attention to the suspect myopathies. First of all, the muscle weakness. So we have to identify the area of the muscle weakness, and also to understand how rapid is the involvement of different kinds of muscle groups in the disease. So, and if this muscle weakness is also present at respiratory level, because the respiratory involvement in several kinds of genetic myopathic disorders is present and progressive, and sometimes is the cause of death of patients. So we also have to consider other kind of disorder that can be also the onset of the disorder, like diplopia, dysphagia, or dysarthria, and all these aspects have to be taken in great consideration. And especially the involvement of the eyes is relevant in several kinds of myopathies. For example, eye disorder like ptosis or ophthalmoplegia is very prominent in mitochondrial disorders as in others. But also we have to take in consideration some specific muscle weakness. For example, there is a sort of recurrent situation, which is the dropped head syndrome, which means that the muscle necks are quite weak. And this could be present in different kind of disorders, but we need to identify this specific symptom, because we know that in some myopathic disorders, this is present. Like, for example, in several myopathic, let me give the myopathies, or also in inflammatory myopathies, but also in some metabolic myopathies, like, for example, Pompe disease. And apart from the specific muscle weakness in different muscle groups, we have also considered to try to better identify the kind of myopathy, the extramuscular involvement. Marianne has alluded to the inclusion of skin rashes, for example, to identify dermatomyositis. But we know that, for example, also apart from the respiratory involvement, also the cardiac involvement is often accompanying the specific muscle disorder. And apart from these specific clinical aspects that we definitely we have to take in great consideration, I remind you that the elevation of CK or a sort of rhabdomyolysis with the presence of dark urines or the so-called Coca-Cola-like urines is very relevant, especially to identify as different kind of metabolic myopathies. So I think that these are the major aspects we have to take in consideration as a starting point to identify the different kinds of myopathies.
So, Marianne, going back to the inflammatory myopathies, do you think that diagnostic delay is still an issue in the diagnosis of myositis?
Well, actually, that's a rhetoric question, Olympia. It's extremely difficult to diagnose a patient if the patient is first seen by someone who is unknown with myositis. And in the Netherlands, I don't know about Italy and other European countries, the patient first has to go to the general practitioner, the GP, and the GP has to refer the patient to a specialist. So if the GP is unaware of the presentations of myositis, it can cause a diagnostic delay. And this in particular holds true for inclusion body myositis, where the diagnostic delay is between 5 to 7 years, usually. And that is because weakness is slowly progressive, but also because weakness can manifest with a very atypical presentations. For instance, unilateral foot drop or dysphagia. We also have to realize that myositis is a multi-system disorder, which not always presents clinically with muscle weakness. For instance, in antisynthetase syndrome, interstitial lung disease or arthritis can be the presenting symptoms. And in dermatomyositis, there can be only skin features and no muscle weakness, which may delay the diagnosis. Patients with connective tissue disorders, such as rheumatoid arthritis or Sjögren's syndrome, may develop myositis in due course, which is called overlap myositis, and the muscle weakness is not always recognized. And finally, we have to realize that myospecific autoantibodies are very helpful for diagnosis, but are only positive in 60% of the cases. So delay of the diagnosis is certainly an issue, because the sooner the therapy is started, the better the outcome.
So thanks, Mariana. Going back to the genetic disorders and talking about red flags, I think we have to say something about advances in terms of treatment of these disorders. And I'm going back to Antonio, if he can give us some clues on advances on treatment of genetic disorders as LGMD or mainly metabolic myopathies, i.e. Pompe disease. Thanks.
Yes, thanks. This is very updated, I would say. Actually, because in the last 5-6 years, we had some innovative treatment for some of the myopathic disorder. So, of course, our wishes go to gene therapy, but still we have not so many defined gene therapies. Although we know that there are several different kinds of disorders that have ongoing several trials, like, for example, myotonic dystrophy or facioscapulohumeral disorders. But still, we do not have the complete results, and we are really anxious to have in the, I would say, in the next 1-3 years, the result of these very ample trials that are ongoing. What we can say is that on some other kind of disorders, we have some solid results. For example, metabolic myopathies, take glycogenosis type 2 or Pompe disease. We have new therapies that have been matured in the last 3 years. You know that Pompe disease has been treated in the past with enzyme replacement therapy. And the enzyme replacement therapy has been largely updated with two new molecules that now are available for the treatment, plus the old one, alglucosidase, and now we have the avalglucosidase and the sipaglucosidase plus miglustat to treat the patients. And this is very important because we know that these kind of therapies are not fully efficient, but also we have to take in consideration that after the first 2-3 years, there is a sort of decline of the efficiency of this kind of the treatments. So to have the opportunity to change in case of decline from one kind of enzyme replacement therapy to another is a very good opportunity, because the patient could be treated longer and with more efficient results. Of course, also in this area, we know that there is a promising gene therapy, and we are really waiting for the results of the trial, which is very close to be finished. And the result seems to be promising as well. But we also have other kind of metabolic disorders that are treated now. For example, mitochondrial myopathies, which is a very large field of different kind of disorders, because the multisystem nature of this kind of disorder. And in this field, for example, Leber disease could be treated by idebenone, But we know that now that there are some drugs that are very close to be recognized by the pharmaco institutions. And we are still waiting for the definition of the treatment of TK2 deficiency, which is a very relevant mitochondrial disorder, as well as others. For example, you know that Friedreich ataxia is somehow a mitochondrial disorder, is considered because the protein involved is included in the mitochondrial area. Also, in this case, we have some news that have to be defined. So I would say that the future is very promising because a big group of patients with myotonic dystrophy or facial scapulohumeral dystrophy or metabolic disorders could be treated or even more largely treated in the next few years, especially waiting for very well-defined gene therapy.
Okay, so going back to myositis, talking about autoimmune disorders, we know that in the last year we have the introduction of several new drugs that involved also the treatment of myositis. So, Marianne, can you give you some advice on this?
Yes, Olympia, I will try to give some examples of very promising developments in myositis, and that holds both for pharmacological and non-pharmacological approaches. As I mentioned before, we need to realize that myositis is a multi-system disorder. Antonio also mentioned that for hereditary myopathies, that often the respiratory muscles and the heart are involved. As I explained, there is antisynthetase syndrome in which the lungs, not the respiratory muscle, but the lungs, as interstitial lung disease is involved. The heart is often involved in a number of subtypes, and the myositis-specific autoantibodies might be very helpful in this regard. As I mentioned, the presence of ILD, interstitial lung disease, in dermatomyositis with MDA5 autoantibodies and cancer in patients with dermatomyositis, TIF1 gamma autoantibody as a risk factor. If that risk factor is present in a dermatomyositis patient, a screening for cancer is required, and not only at diagnosis, but for 3 years after diagnosis. And recently, a very nice guideline has been developed for that with Alexander Oldroyd as the first author. Myositis is a very disabling disease, and only in one third of the cases there is complete remission after therapy with corticosteroids and other immunosuppressants like azathioprine or methotrexate. There are, of course, other second or even third line therapies such as intravenous immunoglobulins, IVIG, and recently an RCT showed the efficacy of IVIG in refractory dermatomyositis patients. However, there is still an urgent need for better therapies. Since the B cell plays an important role in the pathomechanism of dermatomyositis, immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy, and antisynthetase syndrome, rituximab, a classic CD20 targeting antibody drug, is widely used to deplete B cells in various myositis subtypes, which are associated with myositis-specific autoantibodies, albeit a previously conducted randomized controlled trial was negative. That's very interesting. Recently, some spectacular improvements, and maybe you are alluding to that, Olympia, improvement of cases of antisynthetase syndrome and immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy with anti-CD9 CAR-T cell therapy have been reported. And the CAR-T cell therapy has demonstrated strong tissue-penetrating capabilities, leading to stronger and long-lasting B cell wipeout than rituximab. There are currently numerous trials underway to further investigate not only its efficacy, but also the duration of remission and, very important, its side effects. There are drugs available or they are currently investigated in clinical trials based on the pathomechanistic findings of the interferon pathway in dermatomyositis. And tofacitinib, JAK1 specific inhibitor, has shown great promise in treating dermatomyositis, particularly in patients with the anti-MDA autoantibodies. Dampening the humoral response might also be a therapeutic approach. In myasthenia gravis, IgG-lowering strategies, for instance with efgartigimod, has shown to improve outcome, and trials with this medication are currently also underway for myositis. And finally, if there is still some time, Olympia, I would like to stress the importance of exercise as an additional therapeutic approach in patients with myositis. And we should not forget palliative care. In the severe cases of interstitial lung disease, for example, in the MDA5-associated dermatomyositis, and also for patients with IBM inclusion myositis, which is associated with a severe disabling weakness and as yet not amenable to treatment.
Yes, thanks, Marianne, for this overview about the new treatment of myositis. And now we are at the end of this very striking episode where I think we gave an updated overview in terms of diagnosis clue, but also in terms of treatment management of most of the more common, also rare metabolic and not genetic and acquired myopathies. So I want to thank a lot our two guests, Professor Antonio Toscano and Professor Marianne de Visser. And now I can conclude this too. I hope you will enjoy all the episode. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.